Welcome to the Investing Insights podcast from Morningstar.com. This podcast is brought to you by MFS Investment Management, backed by 40 years of essential fixed income. Markets change, but the role fixed income plays shouldn't. That's why we stay true to our traditional approach, essential fixed income. Find out more at mfs.com/fixed income. This week on the podcast, Russ Kinnell on the year in funds, three newly reopened funds for the new year, Baird's Tim Steffen on tax reporting missteps, a bank loan fund pick, a well-positioned software firm, and bargain in the banking sector. Let's get started. Here's Russ Kinnell's analysis on what went wrong and right for mutual funds in 2018.
Hi, I'm Christine Benz from Morningstar.com. The year 2018 ended on a sour note, and most mutual fund categories ended the year in the red. Joining me to provide a recap of the past year's worth of mutual fund performance is Russ Kinnell. He's Director of Manager Research for Morningstar. Russ, thank you so much for being here.
Glad to be here.
Russ, it was a disappointing year, and it really didn't matter whether you were a bond investor or stock investor. So can you discuss some of the forces driving down both stock and bond markets last year?
You're right. There was really red ink across the board,
right,
though bond losses much less so than equities. But I think you had a number of factors going in. You had things like trade tensions, a growing deficit for the U.S., but also really just underscoring all of that, I think, is that we had had a tremendous bull market. Equity valuations were stretched, and so probably more vulnerable than usual for a correction. You know, you can only go so long before you have a correction. So I think all of that was in play. And of course, it's easy with hindsight, but even now, I don't think we know exactly why the market sold off the way it did.
Right, and it's not necessarily done either. In the beginning days here of 2019, we're also seeing some volatility.
That's right. I think that's the real concern, is when you consider how much the market's gone up in the last 8 years, if all we have is that 20% haircut, it's really not a big deal. But the real concern is that obviously could just be the first leg. We tend to overdo it both on the upside and the downside. So there's no reason we couldn't have a real bear market this year.
Okay, really good point. Let's take a look at some of the hardest hit categories as you survey the fund universe. Some pockets of real weakness: energy sector, China was hard hit. What were some of the other areas?
Also, we had foreign small cap funds were hit pretty hard too. In that case, it was really the case of a rising dollar. Most foreign equity funds are not hedged, but also worries about Brexit and other trade issues hurt them. And that's also part of what hurt China. China was hurt by trade tensions with the U.S., declining property prices in China, and just some general worries about growth. And then energy, of course, pretty straightforward. Oil declines, energy stocks go down.
Okay. Let's talk about what we saw on the domestic equity side. You noted that there was a huge bifurcation between large growth stocks and small cap value stocks. And that's interesting because really the large growth stocks, or certainly the technology stocks, have been kind of the epicenter of the recent volatility. But the long run pattern is that large growth stocks have performed very, very well, and indeed did in 2018.
That's right. I've been watching large growth versus small value, and it's a very long run that large growth has outperformed small value, to the point where now if you look at the five-year returns, large growth's returns are about three or four times greater than small value. And interestingly, as you say, even on the downside, large growth lost a lot less than small value. Part of that was because we had a tremendous FANGs rally to start the year, and then a lot of those big tech stocks sold off sharply, but they still were up or not down that much. So you end the year with a small loss for large growth and a pretty big loss for small value. So yet again, we have that tremendous difference in large growth and small value.
Okay, so a question is, if people are looking at their portfolios, potentially doing some repositioning, is small value potentially a place to take a look at?
I think so. I think generally rebalancing is valuable for that discipline because it forces you to invest in the areas of gone down and the areas that may well be the cheapest. So yeah, I think it's an attractive area. Obviously, it's been that way for a number of years.
Right.
So it's not like we can say, aha, now it's going to turn around today. It doesn't work that way.
And I suppose another risk is that some of those small value stocks are pretty cyclical. And so if we are headed into some sort of a broader economic downturn, they could feel some pain.
That's right. And it's no accident that in the last bear market, we saw small value do worse than large growth. The previous bear market, it was the other way around.
Right.
Small value was so cheap that even though it was exposed to the recession, they still did much better than large growth. Large growth got hit in turn because they had gotten priced so high. So it's hard to say how it plays out the next
time.
Every
market environment is a little bit different. Let's talk about some parts, some mutual funds that performed relatively better. You said defensive funds, really across the board, even across asset classes, held their ground better than more aggressively positioned names. So let's start with fixed income. FPA New Income is one that you call out as having held up quite well.
Yeah, FPA New Income is a fund that's really almost always on the defensive or nearly always in its life. And it's a fund that is particularly interested in protecting against both credit risk and rising interest rates. So they've got kind of a quirky portfolio with lots of asset-backed securities, but very much focused on protecting against rising rates. And sure enough, we had interest rates rise and the fund held up really nicely. It's a fund, obviously, in good years, you're unhappy because other funds have much better returns.
Right.
But again, it's a very defensive fund, and it shows at least that those defenses do work.
Okay. On the domestic equity side, one fund that you note performed quite well relative to its peers, that's Yekman Fund. It had been through a spate of relatively weak performance, but really was able to distinguish itself during this recent period of volatility.
That's right. Kind of like FPA New Income, it's a fund that is defensive enough that it tends to lag in bull markets. It's got kind of a high quality slash value tilt, but also they tend to build a lot of cash when they don't find enough to invest in. And so both those things really worked for them. Obviously, cash is going to have a small positive return in just about any year, but also a lot of their quality names actually made a decent return last year. And so after a number of years of lagging, the funds did really nicely in 2018.
Okay. Tweedy Browne Global Value, another fund that we've long talked about as being a relatively conservatively positioned foreign stock fund, it too did quite well.
That's right. In this case, they didn't have that much cash, but they did have quality names. And then on top of that, they hedged their currency. And again, with a rising dollar, that makes a really big difference. So again, being defensive in a slightly different way worked nicely for Tweedy.
Okay. Vanguard Global Minimum Volatility also performed quite well, as one would hope, during a period of market volatility.
Yeah, this is a fund that owns a very wide array of stocks, but again, positioned with towards the lower volatility. And it also hedges, again, with the idea that currency volatility is something that you can take out of the equation in order to produce a steadier return. And that's what they do. And obviously, this is a year where it worked nicely.
Okay. So given all of these forces that are still out there, kind of worrying investors right now, I think it might be tempting to look at some of these very defensively positioned names and go sort of fully on board with them. Would you recommend that? Or what should investors do as 2019 ramps up?
I definitely would not overreact. You know, if you want to tweak your portfolio, maybe you have a really aggressive portfolio, then yes, some of these sort of conservative funds that we talked about are good, but the rallies can be just as violent as the sell-offs. And so you don't want to be so positioned that you're not going to really participate in that rally. So I think some of these conservative funds are nice. They can help you get through the rough times, but you don't want to completely overhaul your portfolio because then you're really driving, looking in the rearview mirror, and that's not a good idea.
Really thoughtful recap. Russ, thank you so much for being here.
You're welcome.
Thanks for watching. I'm Christine Benz for Morningstar.com.
Overwhelmed by the market? Morningstar Premium will help you cut through the noise and find the most promising investments. Get started today with Morningstar Premium.
Next up, three newly reopened funds for the new year.
Hi, I'm Susan Jabinski from Morningstar.com. Mutual funds typically close or otherwise limit new investments when they foresee that ongoing inflows may impact their investing style. In some cases, those funds remain closed, but sometimes closed funds reopen. Here are three Morningstar medalist funds that did just that in 2018.
Silver-rated Mars and Power Small Cap reopened to new investors in September, and that's good news for investors looking for a good option in the small cap space. The fund closed at a fairly conservative $330 million in 2016, but that's typical of this conservative firm that likes to be careful with investors' assets. The managers run this fund well. They execute an excellent process that it favors high-quality businesses with defensible, competitive positions. Investors that understand its process could have anticipated what's happened with the fund over the last couple of years. In 2017, it really struggled. Its good businesses just weren't as favored in that bull market. But in 2018's more volatile market, the fund has done quite well. So again, this is a good opportunity for investors to get into this small cap fund.
Silver-rated FMI International reopened to new investors in April of 2018. The fund is managed by Milwaukee-based Fiduciary Management. It takes a team committee-based approach. Key managers on the fund, though, include Pat English and Jonathan Bloom. They are capacity conscious and picky about the kind of stocks they put in their portfolio. It tends to be a resilient portfolio. A key thing for investors to understand about this fund is they hedge their currency back to the U.S. dollar, and that can sometimes help or hurt returns. It's been a big help in 2018's year-to-date results. Over a full market cycle, we think that this fund should outperform based on the manager's stock picking skills.
IVA International Fund reopened to new investors recently for the first time since 2011. And while it's not appropriate for everyone, it's definitely worth taking a look. Managers Charles DeVoe and Chuck Dillard-Amel have been running this strategy for many, many years, even before the inception of this fund. It's a cautious strategy, and it's unusual. They're looking for stocks that are at a deep discount to what they think they're actually worth, and if they don't find enough of them, they're willing to hold cash. That level's been over 30% at times. It's down to about 18%, at least at the end of October, and it could be lower now because they may have taken more advantage of the drops in the market. They'll also hold gold. They say that's to protect against unforeseen circumstances. So this is not a fund that's going to take full advantage of big rallies in the markets, especially if they're led by growth stocks. And investors who want a fund that will do that would not be happy here. But over time, its cautious, careful, low turnover approach should pay off.
Watch all the Morningstar content you love from your living room. Download the Morningstar Roku channel and get up-to-date independent insights on today's markets. Be comfortable. Be informed.
Now, Tim Steffen of Baird warns about tax reporting missteps.
Hi, I'm Christine Benz from Morningstar.com. Now that we're into the new year, many investors are thinking forward to the next big deadline, April 15th. Joining me to discuss some tax reporting issues that have the potential to trip up investors and taxpayers is Tim Steffen. He's Director of Advanced Planning for Baird. Tim, thank you so much for being here.
Good to be back.
Tim, let's discuss what's changing, some of the highlights in terms of 2018 taxes that will be reflected on people's tax forms in 2019. The 1040 itself is changing.
Yeah, well, so this is the 2018 is really the first year of all these tax reforms that we talked about over a year ago are finally taking effect. So people are going to start seeing them on their returns. Most people should look to see, all things being equal between 2017 and 2018, probably higher levels of taxable income.
Okay.
You've got fewer deductions and changes there, but you've also got new tax rates that apply to everything. You've got changes to things like child credits and AMT and personal exemptions and all these other things that have changed. So, you know, the whole tax return process is going to be a lot different this year than what people may be used to.
Okay. And the form itself is going to look different.
Yeah, there's going to be some pretty drastic changes to the forms. They talked a lot about the whole postcard thing.
Right.
Well, so I guess they can kind of check the box on the postcard thing. They sort of got there. Basically, what they did is they took the old 1040 that we're used to, and instead of two full pages, they cut it to two half pages. So you've got a full piece of paper, but half of it is empty. And to do that, they took a bunch of lines off of the return. And instead of having them be on the 1040, they're on new schedules.
Okay.
So the 1040 says, instead of these seven lines of information you used to provide us, put it all on Schedule 1 or Schedule 2 or Schedule 3. So yes, it's a shorter 1040, but it's actually more pieces of paper.
Okay. So you brought, though, some tax reporting issues that have the potential to trip up investors or at least be a little bit of a head scratcher around tax time. So let's start with the what's called a qualified charitable distribution. You say sometimes people are confused come tax time if they did that QCD. First, let's talk about what that is, but also how that gets reflected or not reflected on their tax return.
Yeah. So qualified charitable distribution, that's when somebody takes money directly from the IRA and sends it to the charity.
Right.
So it doesn't go through you individually. It goes right from the IRA trustee to the charity.
And that's only available to RMD subject investors.
You have to be at least 70 and a half at the time of the gift. So if you're over 70 and a half, you can make that distribution right to the charity. When you do that, the withdrawal from the IRA is not considered taxable income.
Right.
You don't get a deduction for the charitable gift either, because that would be kind of double dipping, but you don't have to report the IRA withdrawal as income. The trick that people run into on that is that your IRA custodian, the brokerage house, wherever you have the IRA held, still has to issue you a 1099 as if it was just a normal distribution out of the IRA that went right to you. So in your mind, you made the gift, you're saying, well, this is tax-free, I don't have to worry about reporting it. All of a sudden, you get a 1099 in the mail from your broker, and you're saying, why did I get this? The issue there is the IRS tells brokers that's what you have to do. They don't necessarily know if you're going to qualify for all the charitable distribution rules, qualified charitable distribution rules. So you might have said go right to the charity, but the IRS or the IRA trustee doesn't necessarily know that that's going to qualify. So they'll issue you a 1099 showing you a distribution that's fully taxable, and then it's up to you to report that on your tax return as actually being a tax-free withdrawal.
Okay.
So the way you do that is, if you can kind of picture the tax form, there's a line for IRA distributions, and on one side it's total distributions, and on another side it's the taxable. You put the total amount on the left-hand side, and right next to it you just write QCD. And whatever portion is not taxable out of that IRA withdrawal, you just leave that off of the column with all the taxable income.
Okay.
So you still have to, you have to report it correctly on your return, make sure your tax preparer knows you did this, because they may not necessarily know. And then also make sure you don't take a separate deduction for the gift as well.
Got it. Okay. Another thing that you said sometimes gets a little bit confusing is if people have made a non-deductible contribution to an IRA. First, why would someone want to do that? Yeah. And second, what sort of paperwork needs to accompany that non-deductible IRA contribution?
So why would somebody make a non-deductible IRA contribution? There's a couple of scenarios. One is they're just looking to put more money into a retirement account and aren't as concerned about the tax benefit of it today. So people who are over a certain level of income and are maybe covered by an employer plan, they are not eligible to take a deduction for an IRA contribution. Their income's too high to do a Roth, which would be the next thing you'd consider.
Right.
So then they say, well, I'll put it into the traditional IRA. I don't get a deduction for it, but at least I'll get some tax-deferred growth on it until I take it out later in life. So they'll put the contribution in there. They may combine that in some cases with this whole backdoor Roth thing where you convert the IRA to a Roth, but that's not necessarily always what happens. Sometimes they just leave it in the traditional IRA. Regardless of what ultimately happens once it's in the IRA, it's still important to report that correctly in your tax return.
Okay, and I do that how?
So the form you're going to use is Form 8606. And that's the form that you use to tell the IRS, I put money into my IRA and I'm not taking a tax deduction for that. The reason you do that is that when you take the money back out of the account later on in retirement, you can take it out tax-free. So that form is incredibly useful to document the fact that this money is in there. It's a cumulative form, so every year you do these contributions, it adds up the total year over year. And then when it comes time during retirement to take it out, you take that money out on a pro rata basis. But at least it tells the IRS you can take that money out tax-free. Now, if you forgot to do that in the past, and we see that happen sometimes, people, they think, well, you know, I'm not going to get a deduction for this. I know I'm too high. So
I did that once.
There you go. I know my income's too high. I'm not going to even bother telling my tax preparer about
it. Right.
That's a mistake, because the preparer needs to know that so they can fill out that form. If you didn't fill out the form, all is not lost. You can go back and fill out a form for the year that you contributed to. So you got to find the old form, which is on the IRS website. You can send that form in. There's a $50 penalty, I think, for each one of those that you file late. But at least you get it documented so that when it comes time to take the money out afterwards, tax-free, you don't have to worry about the IRS questioning where did this come from.
Because all the documentation is there.
Correct.
Okay. Let's talk about capital gains and losses. I think 2018 may be a year when some investors are able to identify losing securities on their books and maybe did some tax loss selling. You said this is an area that can get a little confusing because you have the opportunity to net the gains gains and losses. How does all that work, and what kind of reporting do I have to do on that?
So we at S-Lite, if I've got a long-term loss or gain and a short-term loss or gain, can I use those against each other or offset each other? And the short answer is yes. The way the netting works is, if you look at all of your long-term positions, gains and losses, you combine all those long-term ones into one number, and you come up with a net long-term position. You do the same thing on the short-term side. All your short-term transactions, gains and losses, combine them all together to come up with a net short-term position. Now, those are both gains, then they're both taxable. If they're both losses, you combine them together, and you can use $3,000 of that to offset other income.
Okay.
The rest of that loss carries forward indefinitely, and you can use it every year going forward to offset future gains or the $3,000 per year. If after you've combined them together, you have a gain in one category and a loss in the other category, they can offset each other. So you can use, for example, a short-term loss to offset a long-term gain.
Okay.
Only after they've offset their own kind first. But the short answer is, yeah, you can use losses of one kind to offset gains of the other.
Okay. Last question. It relates to the alternative minimum tax. Mm-hmm. It sounds like fewer taxpayers will be subject to the AMT than in the past. So any thoughts on that and what opportunities might be if you've been subject to AMT in the past?
So the good news is that with all the changes that ran through the tax reform of 2017 and taking effect in 2018, so many of those changes have combined together to really limit, if not almost eliminate, the impact of AMT. Some of the studies I've seen have said that we're going to go from 5 million people paying AMT to 200,000. Hmm. So it's really going to have a drastic impact on who pays it. So the good news is, for some people, they've been if you've been an AMT in the past, you may have built up what's called an AMT credit, meaning that extra tax you paid in a prior year, you get to recover that. Well, you can only recover that in a year when you're not otherwise subject to AMT.
Okay.
So you may have built up a credit years ago because of something you did, and you've never been able to use it because you could never get yourself out of AMT. Well, with these changes this year, so many taxpayers are going to find themselves back out of AMT that those credits, they'll be able to start using some of those now.
Which can further lower their tax bills.
Exactly. You can't ever go below the AMT. AMT is a floor. It's the minimum tax. But that floor has fallen quite a bit because of the way the AMT is calculated. That credit you built up in the prior years, you may be able to use that now. Now, you got to be careful. That credit is hard to calculate. There's a separate form you use on your tax return. It's Form 8801. That's what's used to determine how much of an AMT you paid in a prior year is now creditable in a current year. And so it's a cumulative form. It builds up every year, and it keeps a running total of your credit amount. But for a lot of folks, those credits have been hanging around for a long time. 2018 may be the year they can finally start to use some of those.
Okay. And the good news is if you use a CPA or if you use good tax prep software, they're going to flag a lot of these issues for you and kind of walk you through the right forms,
correct? Exactly. Especially the AMT credit one. The qualified charitable distribution, you'll have to make sure you check the right boxes in some of those. And again, with the IRA, if you don't tell the person you did the contribution, there's nothing they can do. So make sure you tell your preparer or your software that you made the contribution.
Okay, Tim. Always helpful advice. Thank you so much for taking the time to be here.
Good to be here.
Thanks for watching. I'm Christine Benz for Morningstar.com.
This podcast is brought to you by MFS Investment Management, backed by 40 years of essential fixed income. Your fixed income strategies should aim to deliver the essentials for your clients: income, diversification, and risk management. Find out more at mfs.com/fixed income. Next, a bank loan fund that focuses on misrated securities.
A well-executed, thorough process and cheap fees make Virtus Sykes Floating Rate High Income a solid option among bank loan funds. George Gudelius has led the fund since its March 2006 inception, and his co-manager Vincent Flanagan joined him in August 2011. Both maintain sector analyst responsibilities, but they're also supported by 7 seasoned high-yield and bank loan analysts. The team's approach targets securities that it believes are misrated by ratings agencies and show improvement in their underlying credit metrics. It favors the double B and single B tiers of the market, but it also ventures into lower quality territory. Asset-rich industries like healthcare, energy, and broadcasting are usually among the portfolio's top holdings. The fund's long-term record is strong, despite some struggles as oil fluctuated in 2014 and 2015. From its March 2006 inception through November 2018, the fund's 4.3% annualized return outpaced two-thirds of its distinct bank loan Morningstar category peers. Overall, this fund's experienced and stable team, effective, well-executed process and affordable expenses support its Morningstar analyst rating of bronze.
Go from one investment analyst to 150. Sign up today for Morningstar Premium and let our independent and unbiased research staff help you find the best investments. Get started today with Morningstar Premium.
Now, Andrew Lang looks at an undervalued software firm.
We see Blackboard trading at a healthy discount to our recently revised fair value estimate of $87. We assign Blackboard a wide economic moat due to high customer switching costs and intangible assets based on its broad suite of essential relationship management software and deep knowledge and expertise within the social good community. The firm's pedigree as a leading on-premises software provider has changed in recent years, with management committing to a cloud-based business model transition. Although we expect some near-term lumpiness in Blackboard's financial performance due to the transition, we think the firm's ability to maintain its industry-leading longevity remains secure, and we see better lifetime value for customers as they move to Blackboard's cloud platform. As Blackboard focuses on selling integrated cloud solutions to its respective markets, we think the firm can reinforce the stickiness of its solutions as it becomes easier for clients to add additional products. While it is early days in the firm's transition to integrated cloud solutions, we think client conversations are now a return on investment discussion rather than a point product sale. Overall, given Blackboard's leading products, niche markets, and sticky products, we see the firm as well positioned for the future.
Can your portfolio weather the market? Use our premium portfolio tools to identify risks and streamline your holdings. Get started today with Morningstar Premium.
And finally, Eric Compton on banking sector bargains.
. 2018 was a great year for the U.S. banking sector operationally, but a terrible year from a stock performance perspective. We started out bearish on banks in 2018, with valuations seemingly pricing in perfection and bargains were tough to find. However, to start out 2019, we feel valuations have become much more reasonable, and we are even beginning to see some bargains. From a sector perspective, we see one or two more rate hikes likely occurring in 2019, and we are forecasting 2019 to be the last year of material net interest margin expansion. After this, we see rising deposit costs and a slowing rate hike schedule bringing an end to the current NIM expansion cycle. We also still see some excess regulatory capital in the sector, as well as a likely continuation of the strong cost control we saw in 2018. The remaining NIM expansion, continued cost control, and the release of excess capital should roughly balance out the beginning of a normalization of the credit cycle. And as such, we don't see returns on equity sustainably expanding from here on out. We do expect credit costs to normalize over the medium term, as it appears we are in the later stages of the current cycle. However, we don't believe this necessarily means that we are on the verge of another 2008-style downturn for the sector. From a stock perspective, valuations have become much more attractive, and we view Wells Fargo and KeyCorp as the best risk-adjusted values today. Wells is currently trading at roughly a 30% discount to our fair value estimate of $67. This is well below the bank's historical trading multiples and implies that the Wells franchise is in serious decline. We don't see any reason why the current wave of legal charges and regulatory woes won't eventually be in the rearview mirror, and why Wells won't eventually recover to a high teens return on tangible equity and a more reasonable valuation. KeyCorp is also nearly 30% undervalued compared to our current fair value estimate of $21. We believe that KeyCorp fundamentally transformed the franchise following the bank's first Niagara acquisition. Overall, we believe the integration has gone well, and we also believe the bank's credit culture has improved since the crisis. Despite some near-term growth headwinds, we believe the current returns on equity the bank is hitting today are here to stay, and eventually, the market will give KeyCorp credit for its much improved operational performance.
That does it for this week's Investing Insights podcast from Morningstar.com. We hope you have enjoyed our program and we welcome your feedback. Please send your comments and questions to podcast@Morningstar.com. From everyone here at Morningstar, thanks for listening.